feel like I'm gonna kiss you standing beneath that mistletoe.
Yeah, that's Otis Redding and Merry Christmas, Baby. And you're listening to Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. And we're going to speak now with Sarah Flounders. And she is the co-director of the International Action Center, pardon me. And are you there, Sarah?
Yes, hi, Phil. I'm here.
Hey, Sarah, thank you very much for taking the time to talk to us on a holiday evening.
Looking forward, yeah.
You have written a really, a lot of people have been passing your article around. It was published November 29, Workers World. It's titled Why the U.S. Threatens China, and then subtitle as a new superpower. Canada's been hearing a lot about this recently. We have a prime minister and foreign minister who are in sort of part-time meltdown. They have identity problems, whether they're tough or whether they're not. What is this? In the article, you quote the Washington Post with a rather straightforward statement. They say, this is not really a trade war. It's not about trade. It's about something else. What is it about?
Well, that was a great quote. They said the trade war isn't about trade. The trade war is about the United States trying to contain China and counteract its rise. Mm-hmm. And that is pretty clearly what it's about. New York Times had a whole huge, big section, I think 20 pages long, called China Ruled. And they really described both the enormous growth and that it was not expected that the West assumed that China would fail and that they would be able to move in as they did in the actions that led to the collapse of the Soviet Union. And that especially through social media and the internet, they could really have a moment where they were able to grab a hold and disorganize China. That's what they had years, decades of investment were about. So, they've now woken up and realized, oh my goodness, China is actually an economy that's going to pass the U.S. economy within the next 3 to 5 years. And is reorganizing in ways that fundamentally challenge the U.S. position and the world order that's been in existence for the last 75 years that rules the world in very ruthless ways.
Yeah, you point out that they said, well, we're going to compete with you and then, of course, conquer you. But now they've realized, there's two sides to a contest. Maybe they themselves cannot compete.
That is what is terrifying them and leading them to do rash and reckless things. I mean, the extreme tariffs, the political threats, certainly the arrest of Meng Wanzhou from Huawei Corporation. That's certainly an example of that in Canada, but globally, that's sending a threat. That's like a shot across the bow.
Yes.
So it's military confrontations, it's arrests, it's tariffs, and the whole trade war. And all of this together, and it may become much sharper, it will become much sharper, because none of this is likely to stop China. The bigger problem is that the U.S. economy is totally geared toward militarism. The only thing they have to sell on a world scale, along with agricultural products, a lot of soybeans and things like corn, things like that, but is weapons, which quickly become obsolete, leave countries indebted, and does nothing to develop the infrastructure. And China is offering exactly the opposite, and on a huge scale. The loans from China for infrastructure, it now exceeds anything of the World Bank. And on terms that are so much more attractive that it's forcing World Bank and the IMF to recalculate what they're doing. Mm-hmm. So this is a challenge in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. And it isn't likely to change. Every step of military encirclement that the U.S. military, that the Pentagon is making,
yes,
with aircraft carriers and with technology threats, China is countering with really efforts with other countries to expand trade, technology, and development.
Yeah. Yeah, I'd like to, in your analysis, and this is Sarah Flounders we're speaking to, you point out this is a long-term issue. And
yeah.
This, you use the term there about the U.S., and they like to use a basketball expression, they're going to pivot towards South Asia. The man who actually, the first time I heard it was Obama said that.
Mm-hmm.
But then I guess the ball hit his foot and went out of bounds. I don't know, but they seem to be, they still have this pivot on the brain. And they've really done some dangerous things. Can you talk about that?
Well, certainly the biggest thing in terms of military part of the pivot to Asia, this encirclement of China with military bases, these military operations of giant aircraft carriers in the South China Sea, mm-hmm. which is a little bit like sailing into the Gulf of, if Chinese warships sailed into the Gulf of Mexico,
mm-hmm.
and you were suddenly sighted off in New Orleans, you know, mm-hmm. or Key West. But here are U.S. aircraft carriers under what they call freedom of navigation. And they openly discuss how easily it would be to block all Chinese trade with simply one carrier group operating in the Straits of Malacca,
mm-hmm.
off of Indonesia and Malaysia. Very narrow body of water, and 80% of what China is importing and exporting comes through this waterway into East Asia.
Mm-hmm.
So there is a chokehold that they're confronting China subtly with all the time, and not so subtly.
Mm-hmm.
And all of this is meant to increase the pressure, ratchet it up tighter and tighter.
Mm-hmm.
It's, as I say, it's not likely to succeed in stopping China's development because they are not just a market economy. The planned sector of the Chinese economy is growing in its weight and in its ability to respond to this threat.
Mm-hmm.
And that's different from any other, situation in the past that U.S. has dealt with, where they're maneuvering with individual big capitalists and banks.
Mm-hmm.
Imagine, Chase Bank and Bank of America, who wake up one day and realize the four largest banks in the world are state-owned Chinese banks.
Mm-hmm.
Their day has passed. That's a pretty rude awakening, because what have they done with it is ruthlessly underdeveloped whole parts of the world. We have the greatest global poverty and gap between the super rich and the billions who are poor of any time in human history. So this is what capitalism and capitalist development has meant. Now, as I say, China is not a socialist country. It is this mixed economy. Mm-hmm. It has a market economy. It has a planned economy. It has a communist party in China, which is organizing, orchestrating, and trying to plan this. Mm-hmm. Will they be able to keep a hold of all this? We don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But certainly it beats the complete recklessness of consider CEOs in the West. Every single quarter, if they are not maximizing profits, they're out of there.
Yes.
They're incapable of any kind of rational planning on a global scale or even with their own workforce.
Mm-hmm.
They're ruthlessly driven to maximize profit, and it is a you know, what we have here is a very brutal system.
Yeah. Again, it's Sarah Flounders. She's the co-director of the International Action Center. The article is in Workers' World. And I like that you made the point that in the article that so much has been, I guess we did it basically from 1978. They are celebrating it now 40 years. Mm-hmm. Some of the things that have changed, how many people have been lifted from poverty, illiteracy, all the social services that previously were not there. Could you outline some of your thoughts about that?
Well, the figures are pretty stunning. From these are UN, you know, there was a whole campaign to end world poverty. And the UN announced they had actually met their goals, but they had met their goals not because of anything that the United Nations had done, mm-hmm. but because China had far exceeded their goals in terms of lifting hundreds of millions of people, 800 million people pulled out of dire poverty. Mm-hmm. You know, we're talking about in the last 40 years of development. And this is through all different there's great attention now in China to both slow down some of the level of economic growth and focus it on very much on social welfare programs, on alleviating poverty in every part of China, especially the underdeveloped areas, enormous attention on green development. 95% of the electric buses in the world are now in China. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of development on attention on the quality of life.
Mm-hmm.
But even before this, raising 800 million people from dire poverty is a huge accomplishment. Ending illiteracy, and even when you consider the internet and social media, it's far more advanced, actually, in China than anything in the West. People's access to it and the just millions of little creative pieces that they post and chat and short videos and all kinds of things, which are, in other words, there's an impact in the cultural level.
Mm-hmm.
There's a big improvement in healthcare and access to healthcare. Now, none of these things are finished products. There's uneven development. I don't mm-hmm. want to present too glowing. This isn't paradise. But yeah. given where China was
yes.
to what it is today, mm-hmm. and they're up against corporations in the West who frankly could give a damn about what conditions are for the average person in the world.
Or the United States.
The United States especially. I mean, here we are, yeah. a country still without a national health plan.
Yeah.
So the other point just to make is that China has a long memory. And they know, they remember acutely the opium wars that the U.S., British, and other Western powers had entire navies that sailed the Pearl River, Yangtze River, Yellow River. There were navies that never went on the ocean, mm-hmm. special gunboats
mm-hmm.
That plied 1,000 miles inland. And this was Western gunboat diplomacy.
Yep.
Imposing any Chinese merchant you didn't like the deal, you call in the U.S. Navy to go blow up his warehouse because everything trade was along the river.
Yeah.
Of China. China remembers this, and they remember the Opium War intentionally to pull China down, and that this was a huge source. If you look at the rise of capitalism and what gave it the sort of super profits, the aggressive ability, it was the slave trade and the Opium Wars
mm-hmm.
and the theft of indigenous lands. I mean, these are the three crimes on which capitalism is built, and China is acutely aware of not allowing their development to be broken mm-hmm. by the same policies in a modern term. So that's why they're worried about aircraft carriers in the South China Sea or blocking off the Straits of Malacca. They've seen it. They've experienced this within their history. And
it gives them
a
common language with all those countries who also experienced colonialism.
Exactly.
One can see why we do have African leaders and others around the world say we like to do business with China because they don't patronize us. They don't tell us how we have to organize our government. They simply do business.
That's right. Now there will be people who criticize that by saying, well, China is signing trade agreements with countries that may not be the epitome of democracy.
Meet American standards.
Right, exactly. That is what it is, because it's not that the United States is bringing democracy to any country they're doing business with, and certainly Saudi Arabia is the best example of that.
Honduras, et cetera.
Honduras.
Nicaragua, let me think.
Yes, right. We could go on and
Haiti,
on.
Haiti, oh yeah. No.
But with every U.S. trade deal come demands. And that's not true for China. They're both making trade deals, and a lot of them have to do with developing infrastructure and future. It's not just extracting of raw materials. And that's a fundamentally different arrangement. And it's extremely attractive to many countries around the world, because to be able to trade with the country next door instead of war.
Yes.
You could look at the British and U.S. policy to India and Pakistan since independence, since 1948. Everything has been in British and U.S. policy to keep one country against the other and to sell weapons one against the other. It's also true for Egypt and Israel, or you could many, many examples. The wars are in their interests. And with China's Belt and Road, everything is in helping basic parts of the economy integrate trade, whether it's rail and port and exchange of goods that are beneficial to both countries. Now, that's pretty different when there was the Shanghai meeting and you had both the Prime Minister of India and the President of Pakistan there. Both doing business with China, that's a huge step.
Yeah, that's refreshing to see that.
Yeah, exactly.
they don't have to visit Washington first before they go to talk to each other.
Right, and then buy weapons to kill each other.
Yeah, to threaten each other. Yes.
Right, yeah.
Well, Sarah Flounders, it's really a pleasure to talk to you. This is a great article, Why the U.S. Threatens China. We need to know about this here in Canada right now, so we're very grateful. And thank you very much. We hope we talk to you again soon.
Well, thank you for the Taylor Report, because I do very interesting coverage that you're giving. And it's going to take a lot of study. This is an unfinished product for sure. Yeah. It's a growing conflict, and let's continue to study it, look at it, and challenge
the corporate
media. Okay, thank you.
We'll turn to your writing to find out. Thank you.
A good new year to you.
Good new year to you. Bye-bye.